Lorna had money. Lorna always had money. Everybody knew what she did. Sometimes she was generous and sometimes not. It depended on her mood. Besides, she told me she'd help. She just about promised. I started to quiz her on the subject, but decided it would be better to let that pass for now. Go on. Well, I knocked on the door, but she never answered. I saw her car was still there, and I thought maybe she was in the shower or something, so I opened the door and peeked in. She was on the floor. I just stood there and stared. I was so shocked I couldn't even think. Was the door locked or unlocked the night before? I don't know. I didn't try. I didn't even think of it. Anyway, I touched her arm, and she was really cold. I knew she was dead. I could tell just by looking. Her eyes were wide open, and she was staring. It was really gross. What next? I just felt awful. It was horrible. I sat down and started crying. She blinked, staring through the windshield, which was a little dusty for my taste. I figured she was trying to conjure up a quick tear to impress me with the sincerity of her anguish. You didn't call the police? I asked. Well, no. Why not? I'm just curious about your frame of mind. I don't know, she said grudgingly. I was afraid they'd think I did it. Why would they think that? I couldn't even prove where I was earlier because I was at home by myself. Mom was there, but she was sleeping, and Trini still had a job back then. I mean, what if I was arrested? Mom and Dad would have died. I understand. You wanted to protect them, I said blandly. I tried to think what to do. I was really screwed, you know? I'd just been praying for the money, and now it was too late. And poor Lorna, I felt so sorry for her. I kept thinking about all the things she wouldn't get to do, like get married or have a baby. She'd never get to travel to Europe. So you did what? I said, cutting in on her recital. Her voice was getting quavery. She took out a ratty tissue and dabbed at her nose. Well, I knew where she kept her bank book, so I borrowed her driver's license and this passbook. I was so confused and upset I didn't know what to do. I can imagine. Then what? I got in my car and drove down to the valley and took some money out of her savings. How much? I don't remember. Quite a bit, I guess. You closed the account, didn't you? What else was I supposed to do? She said. I figured once they found out she was dead, they'd freeze all her accounts like they did with my grandma. And then what good would it do? She promised she'd help. I mean, it wasn't like she'd turned me down or anything like that. She wanted me to have it. What about her signature? How'd you manage that? We write alike anyway, because I taught her myself before she went to kindergarten. She'd always imitated my writing, so it wasn't that hard to imitate hers. Didn't they ask for identification? Sure, but we look enough alike. My face is fuller, but that's about the only difference. You know, hair color, but everybody changes that. Later, when the news hit the paper, nobody seemed to put it together. I don't even think her picture ran in the paper down there. What about the bank? Wasn't there a closing statement sent out? Sure, but all the mail comes to me at home. Everything from them I pulled out and threw away quick. Well, almost everything, I said. Then what? That's all. What about the earrings? Oh, yeah, I probably shouldn't have done that. She made a face meant to signify regret and other profound emotional responses. I've been thinking I should put the rest of it back. Back where? We still have some of her clothes and stuff. I thought I could stick the jewelry in an old purse, like that was where she kept it, in the pocket of her winter coat or something, and then, you know, discover it and act all amazed. That's certainly a plan, I said. I was missing something, but I couldn't figure out what. Could we get back to the money for just a minute here? After you drove back from Simi, you still had Lorna's driver's license along with the cash. I'm trying to understand what you did next, just so I can get a picture. I don't understand. What do you mean? Well, her driver's license was listed on the police report, so you must have put it back. Oh, sure. I put the license right back where it was. Yeah, that's right. Uh-huh. Like in her wallet or something? Right. Then I realized I'd better make it look like she'd closed the account herself, you know, like she took some money out before she left town. I'm with you so far, I said with caution. Well, everybody thought she was already gone, so all I had to do was create the impression that she was alive all day Friday. Wait a minute. I thought this was Saturday. This all happened Friday? It had to be Friday. The bank's not even open on Saturday, and neither is the travel agent. My mouth did not actually drop open, but it felt as though it did. I turned to stare at her fully, but Berlin didn't seem to notice. She was caught up in her narrative and probably wasn't tuned to my look of astonishment. She was really the most amazing mix of cunning and stupidity, and way too old to be so unaware. I went on home. I was really, really upset, so I told Mom I had the cramps and went to bed. Saturday afternoon I went back to her place and brought the mail in with the morning newspaper. I couldn't see any harm. I mean, dead is dead, so what difference did it make? What did you do with the bank book?
Kept it.
I didn't want anybody to know the money was gone.
So you waited a month and opened a couple of savings accounts.
I was monitoring myself, trying to keep from using what an English teacher would probably refer to as the screaming accusative verb tense. Berlin must have picked up on it to some extent because she nodded, trying to look humble and repentant. Whatever she told herself in the 10 months since Lorna died, I suspect it sounded different now that she was explaining it to me.
"Weren't you worried about your fingerprints showing up at her place?" I said.
"Not really. I wiped off everything I touched so my prints wouldn't show. But even if I slipped up, I figured I had a right to be there. I'm her sister. I've been there lots of times. Anyway, how can they prove when a fingerprint was made?"
"I'm surprised you didn't buy yourself some new clothes or a car."
"That wouldn't be right. I didn't ask her for that stuff."
"You didn't ask her for the jewelry either," I said tartly.
"I figure Lorna wouldn't mind. I mean, why would she care? I was so heartbroken when I found her."
She ceased making eye contact, and her expression took on a troubled cast.
"Anyway, why would she begrudge me when there wasn't anything she could do by then?"
"You do know you broke the law."
"I did?"
"Actually, you broke quite a few laws," I said pleasantly. I could feel my temper beginning to climb. It was like being on the verge of throwing up. I should have kept my mouth shut because I could feel myself losing it.
"But here's the point, Berlin. I mean, aside from grand theft, withholding evidence, tampering with a crime scene, obstructing justice, and God knows what other laws you managed to violate, you've completely fucked up the investigation of your own sister's murder. Some asshole's out there walking around free as a bird right this minute because of you. Do you get that? What kind of fucking twit are you?"
That's when she finally started crying in earnest. I leaned across the car and opened the door on her side.
"Get out. Go home," I said. "Better yet, go to Frankie's and tell your mother what you did before it shows up in my report."
She turned to me, nose red, mascara streaking down her cheeks, nearly breathless from my betrayal.
"But I told you in strictest confidence. You said you wouldn't tell."
"I didn't actually say that, but if I did, I lied. I'm really a wretched person. I'm sorry you didn't understand that. Now get out of my car."
She got out and slammed the door, her grief having turned to fury in 10 seconds flat. She put her face close to the window and yelled,
"Bitch!"
I started the car and backed out, so mad I nearly ran her down in the process. I started cruising the neighborhood, hoping to run into Cheney Phillips somewhere. Maybe he was on call, doing vice rounds like a doctor. Mostly, I was looking for a way to keep occupied while I sorted through the implications of what Berlin had said. No wonder J.D. was nervous, doing everything he could to fix the day and time of his departure with Lita. If Lorna was murdered Friday night or Saturday, they were in the clear. Run it back a day, and everything was up for grabs again. I cut down along Cabana and headed toward C.C.'s. Maybe Cheney was hanging out there. It was not quite midnight. The wind had picked up, moaning through the trees, blowing as if there were a storm in progress, though no rain fell. The surf was being churned up, a wild spray coming off the waves as they boomed against the shore. From a side street to my left, I could hear a car alarm crying, and the sound seemed to carry like the howling of a wolf. Out of the corner of my eye, I caught the flight of a dried palm frond that hurtled down from a tree and skittered across the road in front of me. There were very few cars in the parking lot at the Caliente Café. The place was quiet for a Friday night, with just a smattering of patrons and no sign of Cheney. Before I left, I used the payphone and tried to reach Cheney at home. He was either out or not answering, and I hung up without leaving a message on his answering machine. I wasn't really sure what bothered me more, the story Berlin had told me or Danielle's revelation about Lorna and Clark Esselman. I took a detour through Montebello, feeling unsettled. The Esselman estate was on a narrow lane, without sidewalks or street lamps. My headlights whitewashed the road ahead. The wind was still blowing. Even with my car windows up, I could hear it waffling through the grass. A big limb was down, and I had to slow to avoid it, my eyes following the low wall that edged along the property. All the landscape lights were out, and the house sat in darkness, its angular black shape discernible against the clay-colored sky. There was no moon at all. An owl sailed across the road, touching down briefly in the grassy field on the other side, rising up again with a small dark bundle in its grip. Some death is as silent as the flight of a bird. Some prey as unprotesting as a knot of rags. The front gates were closed, and I could see little beyond the dark shapes of the junipers along the drive. I backed up and turned around, idling my engine while I debated what to do. Later, I'd wonder what might have happened if I'd actually gone ahead and pressed the intercom button and announced myself. It probably wouldn't have made a difference, but one can never be sure. Finally, I put the car in gear and headed back to my place, where I crept into bed. Above me, the wind blew dry leaves across the domed skylight, like the scratchings of tiny feet, something pricking at my conscience while I tossed in sleep. Once, in the dead of night, I could have sworn a cold finger touched the side of my face, and I woke with a start. The loft was empty, and the wind had died to a whisper. My phone rang at noon. I'd been awake for an hour, but unwilling to stir. Having completed my transmigration into the nocturnal realms, I found the notion of getting up any time before 2 repugnant. The phone rang again. It wasn't that I needed more sleep. I simply didn't want to face daylight. On the third ring, I reached for the phone and pulled it into bed with me, tucking the receiver up between my ear and pillow. "Hello? This is Cheney." I propped myself on one elbow and ran a hand through my hair. "Well, hey, I tried calling you last night, but I guess you were out." "No, no, I was here," he said. "My girlfriend was over, and we turned the phone off at 10. What's going on with you?" "Oh, man, we gotta talk. All kinds of shit is coming down on this investigation." "You ain't heard the half of it. I just got a call from a buddy in the sheriff's department. Clark Esselman died this morning in a freak accident."
"He what?"
"You're never going to believe this. The guy was electrocuted in his swimming pool. Dove in to swim some laps and got fried, I guess. The gardener was killed, too. Fellow jumped in to try to save him and died the same way he did. Esselman's daughter said she heard a scream, but by the time she got out there, they were both dead. Luckily, she figured out what was going on and flipped the circuit breaker."
"That's really weird," I said. "Why didn't the breaker cut out to begin with? Isn't that what it's for?"
"Don't ask me. They've got an electrician out there now checking all the wiring, so we'll see what he comes up with. Anyway, Hawthorne's at the house with the crime scene boys, and I'm on my way over. Want me to swing by and pick you up?"
"Give me 6 minutes. I'll be waiting out in front."
"See ya."
When Cheney and I reached the entrance to Clark Esselman's estate, he pressed the button and announced our arrival to a hollow-sounding someone on the other end.
"Just a minute and I'll check," the fellow said and clicked off.
During the drive, I'd told Cheney as much as I could about Esselman's confrontation with Stubby Stockton at the meeting the night before. I'd also told him about my conversation with Berlin and Danielle's claim about Esselman's relationship with Lorna.
"You've been busy," he remarked.
"Not busy enough. I came over here last night thinking I should talk to him. I don't have any idea what I intended to say, but as it turned out, the place was dark, so I didn't think I should rouse the household to quiz him about his rumored kinkiness."
"Well, it's too late now."
"Yeah, isn't it?" I said.
The gate swung open, and we started up the winding driveway, which was bordered with vehicles. 2 unmarked cars, the electrician's truck, and a county car that probably belonged to the coroner. Cheney parked the Mazda behind the last car in line, and we approached on foot. A fire department rescue vehicle and an orange and white ambulance was parked out front, along with a black and white patrol unit from the county sheriff's department. A uniformed sheriff's deputy left his post near the front door and moved to intercept us.
Cheney flashed his badge, confirming his identity, and the two spoke together briefly before the deputy waved us through. "How come you're allowed in?" I murmured as we crossed the porch.
"I told Hawthorne there might be a peripheral connection to a case we've been working. He's got no problem with it as long as we don't interfere," Cheney said.
He turned and pointed a finger at my face.
"You make any trouble and I'll wring your neck."
"Why would I make trouble? I'm as curious as you are." At the front door we paused, stepping aside for the two paramedics from the fire department who were packed up and departing, presumably no longer needed. We moved into the house and through the big country kitchen. The interior was quiet. No audible voices, no droning of the vacuum, no ringing telephones. I didn't see Serena or any of the household staff. The French doors stood open, and the patio, like a movie set, seemed crowded with people whose status and function were not immediately clear. Most loitered at a respectful distance from the pool, but the relevant members of the team were hard at work. I recognized the photographer, the coroner, and his assistant. Two plainclothes detectives were taking measurements for a sketch. Now that we'd been admitted, no one seemed to question our right to be present. From what we could ascertain, it hadn't yet been established that a crime had been committed, but the scene was being treated with meticulous attention because of Esselman's high standing in the community. Both Esselman's body and that of the gardener had been removed from the water. They lay side by side, covered discreetly with tarps. Two sets of feet were visible, one bare and one shod in work boots. The bottoms of the bare feet were marked by an irregular pattern of burns, the flesh blackened in places. There was no sign of the dog, and I assumed he'd been locked up somewhere. The second set of paramedics stood together quietly, probably waiting for the okay from the coroner to transport the bodies to the morgue. It was clear they had no further business to conduct. Cheney left me to my own devices. He was only marginally more entitled to be there than I was, but he felt free to circulate, while I thought it was smarter to keep a low profile. I turned and looked off toward the adjacent properties. By day, the rolling lawns were patchy, the grasses interseeded with a mix of fescue and Bermuda, the latter currently dormant and forming stretches of tatty brown. The flowering shrubs that surrounded the patio formed a waist-high wall of color. I could see exactly where the gardener had been working that morning, because the hedge he'd been clipping was crisply trimmed across one section and shaggy after that. His electric clippers lay on the concrete where he must have dropped them before he jumped into the water. The lap pool looked serene, its dark surface reflecting a portion of the steeply pitched roof. Perhaps it was an artifact of my overactive imagination, but I could have sworn the faint scent of cooked flesh still lingered in the morning air. I wandered across the patio toward the breezeway that connected the four garages to the house, and then I ambled back. I didn't see how Esselman's death could be an accident, but neither did I understand how it could be connected to Lorna's death. It was possible he'd killed her, but it didn't seem likely. If he felt remorse for their relationship, or if he feared exposure, he might have elected to commit suicide. But what a bizarre way to go about it. For all he knew, Serena might have been the one who happened on the scene, and she'd have died along with him. I noticed activity at the side of the house closest to the pool. The electrician talking with the two detectives. He gestured his explanation, and I could see all of them looking from the electrical panel to the equipment shed that housed the pump, the filter, and the big heater for the pool. The electrician moved over to the side of the pool near the far end. He hunkered, still talking, while one of the detectives peered down into the water, squinting. He got down on his hands and knees and leaned closer. He asked the electrician a question, and then took off his sport coat and rolled up his sleeve, reaching into the depths. The photographer was summoned, and the detective began to detail a new set of instructions. She reloaded her camera and changed the lens. The other detective crossed to the coroner's assistant, and they conferred. The coroner had stepped back, and the two paramedics began to prepare the bodies for removal to the ambulance. From where I was standing, I could see the news ripple across the assembled personnel. Whatever the information, it spread from twosome to twosome as the group rearranged itself. The detective moved off, and I eased my way toward the coroner's assistant, knowing if I were patient, the news train would eventually reach my little station. The electrician had left his toolbox on the patio table, and he came over to pick it up. In the meantime, the deputy was talking to the fingerprint tech, who hadn't had much work to do so far. The three of them began to chat, looking back toward the pool. I overheard the electrician use the word deify, and my thoughts jumped to the transcript I'd been discussing with Hector. I laid a hand on his arm, and he glanced back at me. "Excuse me, I don't mean to butt in, but what did you say?"
"I said there's a problem with the GFI. Wires come loose, which is why the circuit breaker didn't trip like it should have. One of the pool lights is busted out, and that's what sent current through the water."
"I thought the term was GFCI, ground fault circuit interrupter."
"Same thing. I use both. GFI is easier, and everybody knows what you mean."
The electrician was a clean-cut kid in his 20s, one of that army of experts who make the civilized world run a little more smoothly.
"Damnedest thing I ever saw," he remarked to the deputy. "Break an underwater flood like that, you'd have to take a stick and poke it out from on top. Detective's going to find out when the pool was last serviced, but somebody really blew it. We're talking a big lawsuit, and I mean big."
The fingerprint technician said,
"Think the gardener could have done it?"
"Doing what? You don't punch out a pool light by accident. I told the detective that glass is tough. It takes work. If it had been at night with the pool lights on, somebody might have noticed. Daytime like this and all that black tile, you can hardly see the near end, let alone the far."
From the other side of the patio, the detective motioned the electrician back, and he moved in that direction. Where I was, the deputy and the fingerprint technician had shifted the discussion to somebody who'd been electrocuted by his electric lawnmower, because his mother, trying to be helpful, stuck the 3-pronged plug into a 2-pronged extension cord. The insulation on the neutral wire was defective, which caused direct contact between the cord and the metal handle of the mower. The deputy went into quite a bit of detail about the nature of the damage, comparing it to another case he'd seen where a child bit through an electric cord while standing in a puddle of water in the bathroom. I kept thinking about the tape recording, thinking about the phrase, "She goes in at the same time every day." Maybe Esselman wasn't the intended victim. Maybe Serena was meant to die instead. I looked for Cheney, but couldn't seem to find him. I approached the nearest of the two detectives. "Would you have any objection if I talked to Mr. Esselman's daughter? It won't take but a minute. I'm a friend of hers," I said.
"I don't want you discussing Mr. Esselman's death. That's my job."
"It's not about him. This is about something else." He studied me for a moment and then glanced away.
"Keep it brief," he said.
Chapter 20. I went through the kitchen toward the front of the house. In the foyer, I took a right and headed up the stairs. I had no idea how the bedrooms were laid out. I moved down the hallway from room to room. At the end of the corridor, there was an intersecting T with a sitting room on the right and a bedroom on the left. I could see Serena lying on a 4-poster bed covered with a light blanket. The room was sunny and spacious, yellow and white paper on the walls in a tiny rosette print. There were white curtains at the window, and all the woodwork was done in white. Serena didn't seem to be asleep. I knocked on the doorframe. She turned her head and looked at me. I didn't think she'd been crying. Her face was pale, unmarked by tears, the expression in her eyes more one of resignation than sorrow, if one can make that distinction. She said,
"Are they finished out there?"
I shook my head. "It'll probably be a while. You want me to call anyone?"
"Not really. I called Roger. He's coming over as soon as he can get away from the plant. Did you want something?"
"I need to ask you a question, if you can tolerate the intrusion."
"That's all right. What is it?"
"Do you use the pool on a daily basis?"
"No, I never liked swimming. That was Daddy's passion. He had the lap pool put in about 5 years ago."
"Does someone else here swim? One of the maids or the cook?" She thought about it briefly.
"Occasionally a friend might call and ask to use the pool, but no one else," she said. "Why?"
"I heard a taped conversation under circumstances I'd prefer not to go into. Lorna was talking to a man who used the phrase, 'She goes in at the same time every day.' I thought the reference might be to swimming, but at the time it made no sense. I was just wondering if there was a she on the premises who went in at the same time every day."
She smiled wanly. "Just the dog, and she only goes in when Dad does. You saw her the other night. They play fetch, and then when he does his laps, she swims alongside him."
I could feel a flicker of confusion. "I thought the dog was a male. Isn't his name Max?"
"It's Maxine. Max for short," she said. "Actually, her real name's much longer because she's pedigreed."
"Ah, Maxine. How's she doing? I didn't see her downstairs. I thought she might be up here with you."
Serena struggled into a sitting position. "Oh, heavens, thanks for reminding me. She's still at the groomer's. I took her over first thing this morning. The shop owner even came in early to accommodate the appointment. I was supposed to pick her up at 11, but it completely slipped my mind. Ask Mrs. Holloway if she'd go over there. At least call and let them know what's happened.
Poor Max, poor girl. She's going to die without Daddy. The two of them were inseparable."
"Mrs. Holloway's the housekeeper? I haven't seen her either, but I can call if you like."
"Please. Maybe Roger can pick her up on his way over here. It's Montebello Pet Groomers in the Lower Village. The number's on the planning center in the kitchen. I don't want to put you to any trouble."
"It's no trouble," I said. "Are you okay?"
"Really, I'm fine. I just want some time alone, and then I'll be down. I'll probably have to talk to the detective again anyway. I can't believe this is happening. It's all so grotesque."
"Take your time," I said. "I'll tell the pet groomer someone's picking Max up later. You want this closed? It might be quieter."
"All right, and thank you."
"That's all right. I'm sorry about your father."
"I appreciate that."
I left the room, pulling the door shut behind me. I went down to the kitchen and put a call through to the grooming shop. I identified myself as a friend of Serena's, indicating that her father had died unexpectedly. The woman was extremely gracious, expressing her condolences. The shop was closing at 3, and she said she could just as easily drop Max off on her way home. I left a note to that effect, assuming that Mrs. Holloway or Serena would spot it. By the time I returned to the patio, the bodies had been removed, and the photographer had packed up and left. There was no sign of the electrician, the coroner, or his assistant. The fingerprint technician was now working over by the pool equipment. At the near end of the pool, I saw Cheney talking to the younger of the two detectives, his buddy Hawthorne, I gathered, though he never introduced us. When he spotted me, he finished up his conversation and crossed the patio to me.
"I was wondering where you went. They're nearly done here. You want to head out?"
"We might as well," I said. We didn't say much until we'd left the house, walking down the driveway to the spot where Cheney's car was parked. I said, "So what's the current theory? It couldn't have been an accident. That's ludicrous." Cheney unlocked the door and held it open for me.
"Doesn't look like it on the surface, but we'll see what they come up with."
He closed the door on my side, effectively cutting off communication. I leaned over and unlocked the door on his side, but I had to wait until he'd gone around and let himself in. He slid under the steering wheel. "Quit being such a stickler and play the game," I said. "What do you think?"
"I think it's dumb to guess."
"Oh, come on, Cheney. It had to be murder. Somebody busted out the pool light and then disconnected the GFI. You don't believe it was an accident. You're the one who told Hawthorne there might be a peripheral connection between Lorna's death and Desselman's."
"What connection?" he said perversely.
"That's what I'm asking you," I said. "God, you're aggravating. Okay, I'll go first. Here's what I think." He rolled his eyes, smiling, and turned the key in the ignition. He put his arm across the seat and peered out of his rear window, backing out of the gate with a breathtaking carelessness. When he reached the road, he threw the gear into first and peeled out. On the way back to my place, I told him about Lita's surreptitious tape recording. I didn't have the transcription with me, but the text was so sketchy that it wasn't difficult to recollect. "I think the guy is telling her about his scheme. He's coming up with a way to kill Esselman, and he's feeling clever. Maybe he thought she'd find it amusing, but she obviously doesn't. You ought to hear her on the tape. She's pissed off and upset, and he's trying to act like it's all a big joke. The problem is, once he's told her, he's left himself open. If he actually intends to go through with it, she'll know it was him. Given her reaction, he can't trust her to keep quiet."
"So what's your theory? Bottom line," he said.
"I think she was killed because she knew too much." He made a face.
"Yeah, but Lorna died back in April. If the guy wanted to kill Esselman, why wait this long? If the only thing that worried him was her blowing the whistle, why not kill the old guy the minute she's dead?"
"I don't know," I said. "Maybe he had to wait until things cooled down. If he'd moved too quickly, he might have called attention to himself." He was listening, but I could tell he wasn't convinced.
"Go back to the murder scheme. What's the guy intend to do?"
"I think he's talking about a variation on what actually happened. Clark and Max go through the same routine every morning. He throws a stick into the lap pool and she fetches. She's a retriever. She was born for this stuff. After they play, the two swim. So here's the deal. Suppose the pool's been electrified. He throws the stick. She leaps in and takes a big jolt. He sees she's in trouble. He goes in after her and he dies too. It looks like an accident, some freaky set of circumstances everyone feels bad about. Poor guy. Tried to save his doggy and died in the process. In reality, Serena took the dog to the groomers, so Clark went in swimming by himself. Instead of Clark and the dog, you have Clark and the gardener, but the setup's the same. Cheney was quiet for a moment.
How do you know it's Lorna on the tape? He said. You've never heard her voice. The guy could be talking to Serena.
Why would she be there in the first place? I asked promptly. I noticed it was more fun to ask questions than to answer them.
Haven't made that part up yet. The point is, Serena's upset because she doesn't want the dog used as bait, so she takes Max off to the groomers to get her out of the way.
I've talked to Serena. The voice didn't sound like hers.
Wait a minute, that's cheating. You told me the voices were distorted. You've talked to J.D. and you said it didn't sound like him either.
That's true, I said reluctantly. But you're suggesting Serena killed her own father, and I don't believe it. Why would she do it?
The guy's got a lot of money. Doesn't she inherit his estate?
Probably, but why kill him? He'd already had a heart attack, and his health was failing. All she had to do was wait, and probably not very long at that. Besides, I've seen her with him. There was nothing but affection. An occasional complaint about his stubbornness, but you can tell she admired him. Anyway, I'll see if I can get the tape back, and you can hear it for yourself.
Who has it?
Lita. She sent J.D. over to pick it up last night. Or that was his claim. Actually, in the suspect department, they're not bad candidates. Both of them were nervous I'd give the tape to the police. Neither has an alibi. And you know what J.D. does for a living? He's an electrician. If anybody'd know how to hotwire a lap pool, he would.
The town's full of people who'd know enough to do that, he said. Anyway, if your theory's correct, then whoever killed Esselman had to be someone who knew the house, the pool, and the routine with the dog.
That's right.
Which brings us back to Serena.
Maybe, I said slowly. Though Roger Bonney's another one who'd know all that.
What's his motive?
I have no idea, but he's certainly the link between Lorna and Esselman.
Well, there you have it, Cheney snorted. Now if Roger knows Stubby, the circle will be complete and we can charge him with murder.
Cheney was being facetious, but he'd made a good point, and I could feel a ripple of uneasiness. My thoughts veered to Danielle and the man who'd walked off into the darkness of the alleyway. How do we know this isn't the same guy who went after Danielle? Maybe the attack on her connects up to everything else. Cheney had reached my place, and he slowed to a stop. He pulled on the brake and put the car in neutral, turning to face me, his smile gone.
Do me a favor and think about something else. It's a fun game, but you know as well as I do it doesn't mean Jack.
I'm just trying on theories, like throwing dinner plates against the wall to see if one will stick. He reached over and gave my hair a little tug.
Just watch yourself. Even if you're right and all these things are related, you can't go tearing off on your own, he said. This case belongs to the county sheriff. It's got nothing to do with you.
I know.
Then don't give me that look. It's nothing personal.
It is personal, especially when it comes to Danielle, I said.
Would you quit worrying? She's safe.
For how long? Any day now, they'll move her out of ICU. Hospitals aren't exactly high security. You ought to see the people walking in and out of there.
You're right about that. Let me think some and see what I can do. We'll talk soon, okay?
He smiled, and I found myself smiling in return.
Okay. Good. I'll give you the number for my pager. Let me know if anything turns up.
I'll do that, I said. He recited the number and had me repeat it back to him before he put the car in gear again. I stood at the curb and watched the Mazda pull away, and then moved through the gate and went around to the rear. It was Saturday afternoon, close to 3 o'clock. I let myself into my apartment. I made a note of Cheney's pager number and left it on my desk. I felt I was in a state of suspended animation. The answer was hovering somewhere on the periphery, like spots in my field of vision that moved sideways every time I turned to look. There had to be some chain of events, something that linked all the pieces of the puzzle.
I needed a way to distract myself, setting all the questions aside until a few answers came. I went up the spiral stairs to the loft and changed clothes, pulling on my sweatsuit and my jogging shoes. I tucked the house key in my pocket and trotted over to Cabana Boulevard. The day was crisp and clear, the mid-afternoon sun pouring over the distant mountains like a golden syrup. The ocean was a dazzling carpet of diamonds, the air freshly scented with the briny smell of the sea. The run was a pleasure, bringing back in full measure the joys of physical activity. I did 4 miles, feeling strong, and when I came back I took a shower and started over, eating cereal and toast while I read the paper I hadn't had time for that morning. I went out and ran an errand or two, picking up groceries, stopping at a wine store. It was close to 6 o'clock when I finally felt relaxed enough to sit down at my desk and flip the light on. I went back to my index cards. I was going through the motions, not really on the track of anything in particular, just trying to keep busy until I figured out what to do next. I glanced down at the sack that held the broken picture frames. Shit. Of course I'd forgotten to take Danielle's bedding to the cleaners before it closed, but at least I could switch the frames. I moved over to the kitchen counter with the new frames I'd picked up. I put the wastebasket nearby and pulled the photographs from the paper bag. There were 4 8x10 enlargements, all in color. I removed the frame and the matting from the first, pausing to study the image. 3 cats lounging on a picnic table. A sleek gray tabby was in the process of jumping down, apparently not that happy about the photographic immortality. The other 2 cats were long-haired, one pale cream and one black, staring at the camera with expressions of arrogance and disinterest, respectively. On the back, she'd written the date and the cats' names, Smokey, Tigger, and Cheshire. As I removed the photo from the cracked frame, the glass separated into 2 pieces. I tucked both in the trash can and tossed the frame in after them. I pulled out a new frame and peeled off the price tag, sliding the mat and the cardboard backing out of the frame. I tucked the photo between the backing and the mat, turning it over to make sure the image was straight. I eased the 3 layers, mat, photo, and backing, into the space between the glass and the series of staples that were sticking out of the frame. I turned it back again. It looked good. I picked up the 2nd photograph and went through the same process. The glass was only cracked across 1 corner, but the frame itself was unsalvageable. This photograph showed 2 young men and a woman on a sailboat, everyone with beer cans, sunburns, and wind-tangled hair. Danielle had probably taken the picture herself. It must have been a good day with good friends at a time in her life when she was still in possession of her innocence. I've been on outings like it. You come home dog-tired and dirty, but you never forget. In the 3rd picture, Danielle was posed under a white trellised arch in the company of a young, clean-cut guy. From the dress she was wearing, complete with an orchid on her wrist, I guessed this was taken at her high school prom. It was nice getting a glimpse of her private life, images of her as she'd been before. She had entered the life as surely as a novice entering a convent, with a gap just as wide between past and present. The last picture had been rematted, a wide band of gray reducing the framed image to its 2 central figures, Danielle and Lorna dressed up and sitting in a booth. It looked like a commercial photograph taken by a roving photographer who made a living snapping pictures on the spot. Hard to tell where this was taken, Los Angeles or Vegas, some glitzy nightclub with dinner and dancing. In the background, I could see a portion of a bandstand and a potted plant. Champagne glasses on the table in front of them. The frame was cheap, but the wide gray matting was a nice choice for the subject matter, isolating the 2 of them. Both women were looking elegant, seated at a round table in a black, leather-padded booth. Lorna was so beautiful, dark-haired, hazel-eyed, with a perfect oval face. Her expression was grave, with just the smallest hint of a smile on her lips. She wore a black satin cocktail dress with long sleeves and a square, low-cut neckline. The diamond hoop earrings sparkled at her ears. Danielle wore Kelly Green, a form-fitting sequined top, probably with a miniskirt, if I knew Danielle's taste. Her long dark hair had been smoothed into a French roll. I imagined Lorna getting her all dolled up for a kind of high-class date. 2 call girls on the town.
Along the back of the booth, I could see a man's hand and arm extending behind Lorna. I could feel my heart begin to thump. I extracted the photograph from the frame and turned it over. With the matting removed, I could see all four people who'd been sitting at the table that night. Roger, Danielle, Lorna, and Stubby Stockton. Oh, man, this is it, I thought. This is it. Maybe not everything, but the heart of the riddle. I carried the photo with me to the telephone and called Cheney's pager number, punching in my own telephone number and the pound sign at the sound of the tone. I hung up. While I waited for him to return my call, I sat at my desk and sorted through my notes, pulling all the index cards on which Roger was mentioned. Most were from my initial interview, with additional notes from my conversation with Serena. I scanned the cards on the bulletin board, but there were no further references. I laid the cards out on my desk like a tarot reading. I found the notes I'd scribbled to myself after my meeting with him. Roger had told me Lorna called him Friday morning. I circled the day and added a question mark, affixing the card to the photograph with a paper clip. The phone rang. "Kinsey Milhone," I said automatically. "This is Cheney. What's up?" "I'm not sure. Let me tell you what I came across, and you tell me." I told him briefly how I'd acquired the photographs, and then I detailed the one I was looking at. "I know you were kidding when you talked about Roger and Stubby, but they did know each other, and well enough to go whoring together somewhere out of town. I also went back through my notes and came across an interesting discrepancy. Roger told me Lorna called him Friday morning, but she couldn't possibly have done that. She was dead by then." There was a brief silence. "I don't see where you're going with this." "I have no idea. That's why I'm calling you," I said. "I mean, suppose Roger and Stubby were in business together. If Lorna told Roger about her relationship with Esselman, they could have been using the information to pressure him. Esselman balked.
So Stubby killed him? That's ridiculous. Stubby's got a lot of irons in the fire. This deal doesn't work, he's got another one lined up, and if that fails, he's got more. Believe me, Stockton is in business to do business, period. If Esselman dies, that only sets him back, because now he's got to wait until someone's appointed to take Clark's place, yada, yada, yada.
I'm not saying Stockton. I think it's Roger. He's the one who had access to that pool equipment. He had access to Lorna. He had access to everything. Plus, he knew Danielle. Suppose he and Stockton talked business that night. Danielle's the only witness.
How are you going to prove it? All you have is speculation. This is all air and sunshine. You've got nothing concrete. At least nothing you could take to the DA. He'd never go for it.
What about the tape?
That's not proof of anything. It's illegal for starters, and you don't even know it's Lorna. They could be talking about anything. You ever heard the concept of fruit of the poisonous tree? I've been thinking about this whole business ever since I dropped you off. You got people tampering with the crime scene, tampering with evidence. Any good defense attorney would rip you to shreds.
What about Roger's claim Lorna called him Friday morning?
So the guy was mistaken. She called some other day.
What if I went in with a wire and had a talk with him? Let me ask... Cheney cut in, his tone a mixture of impatience and outrage.
Ask him what? We're not going to wire you. Don't be asinine. What are you proposing? You go knock on his door? Hi, Rog, it's Kinsey. Who'd you kill today? Oh, no reason, just curious. Excuse me, would you mind speaking into this artificial flower I'm wearing in my lapel? This is not your job. Face it, there's nothing you can do.
Bullshit, that's bullshit.
Well, it's bullshit you're going to have to live with. We really shouldn't even be discussing this.
Cheney, I'm tired of the bad guys winning. I'm sick of watching people get away with murder. How come the law protects them and not us?
I hear you, Kinsey, but that doesn't change the facts. Even if you're right about Roger, you got no way to nail him, so you might as well drop it. Eventually he'll screw up and we'll get him then. We'll see. Don't give me we'll see. You do something stupid and it's your ass, not his. I'll talk to you later. I got another call coming in.
I hung up on him, steaming. I knew he was right, but I really hate that stuff, and his being right only made it worse. I sat for a minute and stared at the photograph of Lorna and Danielle. Was I the only one who really cared about them? I held the missing piece of the puzzle, but there were no options open to me, no means of redress. There was something humiliating about my own ineffectiveness. I crossed the room and paced back, feeling powerless. The phone rang again, and I snatched up the receiver.
"This is Cheney."
His voice was oddly flat. "Hey, great. I was hoping you'd call back. Surely between us there's a way to do this," I said. I thought he was calling to apologize for being such a hard-ass. I expected him to offer a suggestion about some action we might take, so I was completely unprepared for what came next.
"That was St. Terry's on the line, the ICU nurse. We lost Danielle. She just died," he said.
I felt myself blink, waiting for the punchline. "She died?"
"She went into cardiac arrest. I guess they coded her, but it was too late to pull her back."
"Danielle died? That's absurd. I just saw her last night."
"Kinsey, I'm sorry. The call just came in. I'm as surprised as you are. I hate to be the one to tell you, but I thought you should know."
"Cheney!"
My tone was rebuking, while his had become compassionate.
"You want me to come over?"
"No, I don't want you to come over. I want you to quit fucking with my head," I snapped. "Why are you doing this?"
"I'll be there in 15 minutes.
The line clicked out, and he was gone. Carefully, I set the receiver in the cradle. Still standing, I put a hand across my mouth. What was this? What was happening? How could Danielle be dead while Roger was beyond reach? At first, I felt nothing. My initial response was a curious blank. No sensation at all. I took in the truth content of what Cheney had told me, but there was no corresponding emotional reaction. Like a monkey, I plucked up this bright coin of information and turned it over in my hand. I believed in my head, but I couldn't comprehend with my heart. I remained motionless for perhaps a minute, and when feelings finally crept back, what I experienced wasn't grief, but a mounting fury. Like some ancient creature hurtling up from the deep, my rage broke the surface and I struck. I picked up the receiver, put my hand in my jeans pocket, and pulled out the card I'd been given in the limousine. The scribbled number was there, some magical combination of digits that spelled death. I dialed, giving absolutely no thought to what I was doing. I was propelled by the hot urge to act, by the blind need to strike back at the man who had dealt me this blow. After 2 rings, the phone was picked up on the other end.
"Yes?"
I said, "Roger Bonney killed Lorna Kepler." I hung up. I sat down. I felt my face twist with heat, and tears spilled briefly. I went into the bathroom and looked out the window, but the street beyond was dark. I went back to my desk.
Oh, Jesus, what had I done?
I picked up the phone and dialed the number again. Endless rings. No answer. I put the phone down. Hands shaking, I pulled my gun from the bottom drawer and popped in a fresh clip. I eased the gun into the waistband at the back of my jeans and pulled on my jacket. I grabbed my handbag and car keys, turned out the lights, and locked the door behind me. I hit the 101 heading out toward Colgate. I kept checking my rearview mirror, but there was no sign of the limousine. At Little Pony Road, I took the off-ramp and turned right, continuing past the fairgrounds until I reached the intersection at State. I stopped at the traffic light, drumming my fingers on the steering wheel in impatience, checking my rearview mirror again. Along the main thoroughfare, there was only one touch of color, words written out in red neon on the drugstore I spotted. "Save on," the sign said. The shopping mall to my left was apparently having a gala all-night sale. Klieg lights pierced the sky. White plastic flags were strung from pole to pole. At the entrance to the parking lot, a clown and 2 mimes were motioning for passing cars to turn in. The 2 mimes, in whiteface, began a playlet between them. I couldn't tell what silent drama the 2 were enacting, but one turned and looked at me as I pulled away from the light. I checked back, but all I saw was the painted sorrow on his downturned mouth. I sped past a darkened service station, the bays and gasoline pumps shut down for the night. I could hear a burglar alarm clanging, apparently in a shop close by, but there was no sign of the police, and no pedestrians running to see what was wrong. If there were actually burglars in the place, they could take their sweet time. We're all so accustomed to alarms going off that we pay no attention, assuming the switches have been tripped in error and mean nothing. 6 blocks beyond, I crossed a smaller intersection, heading up the road that led to the water treatment plant.
The area was largely unpopulated. I could see an occasional house on my right, but the fields across the road were scruffy and dotted with boulders. Coyotes yipped and yowled in the distance, driven down from the hills by the need for water. It seemed too early in the evening for predators, but the pack was obeying a law of its own. They were hunting tonight, on the scent of prey. I pictured some hapless creature flying across the ground in fear of its life. The coyote kills quickly, a mercy for its victim, though not much consolation. I turned into the entrance to the treatment plant. Lights were on in the building, and there were 4 cars out front. I left my handbag in the car, locking it behind me. There was still no sign of the limousine. Then again, the guy wouldn't use his limo to make a hit, I thought. He'd probably send his goons, and they might well check Roger's place first, wherever that might be. A county-owned truck had been parked in the drive. As I passed, I put a hand out. The hood was still warm to the touch. I went up the stairs to the lighted entry. I could feel the reassuring bulk of the handgun in the small of my back. I pushed through the glass doors. The receptionist's desk was empty. Once upon a time, Lorna Kepler had sat there. It was curious to imagine her working here day after day, greeting visitors, answering the telephone, exchanging small talk with a control technician and senior treatment mechanics. Maybe it was her last shred of pretense, the final gesture she'd made toward being an ordinary person. On the other hand, she might have found herself genuinely interested in aeration maniforms and flash mix basins. The interior of the building seemed quiet at first. Fluorescent lights glowed against the polished tile floors. The corridor was deserted. From one of the rear offices, I picked up the strains of a country music station. I could hear someone banging on a pipe, but the sound came from deep in the bowels of the building. I moved quickly down the hallway, glancing left into Roger's office. The lights were on, but he was nowhere to be seen. I heard footsteps approaching. A fellow in coveralls and a baseball cap came around the corner, moving in my direction. He seemed to take my presence for granted, though he took his cap off politely at the sight of me. His hair was a mass of curly gray, mashed into a cap-shaped line around his head. "Can I help you with something?"
"I'm looking for Roger."
The fellow pointed down.
"That's him you hear wumping on the sample lines."
He was in his 50s, with a wide face and a dimple in his chin. "Nice smile." He reached out a hand and introduced himself.
"I'm Delbert Squalls."
"Kinsey Milhone," I said. "Could you let Roger know I'm here? It's urgent."
"Sure, no problem. Actually, I'm just on my way down. Why don't you follow me?"
"Thanks." Squalls retraced his steps and opened the glass-paneled door into the area I'd seen before. Multicolored pipes, a wall of dials and gauges. I could see the gaping hole in the floor. Orange plastic cones had been set across one end, warning the unwary about the dangers of tumbling in. I said, "How many guys you have working tonight?"
"Let me see. 5 counting me. Come on this way. You're not claustrophobic, I hope."
"Not a bit," I lied, following him as he crossed to the opening. On my previous visit, I'd seen a moving river of black water down there, silent, smelling of chemicals, looking like nothing I'd ever seen before. Now I could see lights and the bleak walls of concrete, discolored in places where the water had passed. I felt the need to swallow. "Where'd all the water go?" I asked.
"We shut the sluice gates, and then we have a couple of big basins it drains into," he said conversationally. "Takes about 4 hours. We do this once a year. We got some post-aeration sample lines in the process of repair. They'd almost completely corroded. Been clogged for months until this shut down. We got 10 hours to get the work done, and then back she comes."
A series of metal rungs affixed to the wall formed a ladder leading down into the channel. The banging had stopped. Delbert turned around and edged his foot down into the opening, and then proceeded to descend. Tink, tink, tink went the soles of his shoes on the metal rungs as he sank from sight. I moved forward, turning myself. Then I descended, as he had, to the tunnel below. Once we reached bottom, we were 12 feet underground, standing in the influent channel through which millions of gallons of water had passed. Down here it was always night, and the only moon shone in the form of a 200-watt bulb. The passage smelled damp and earthy. I could see the sluice gate at the dark end of the tunnel, streaks of sediment on the floor. This felt like spelunking, not a passion of mine. I spotted Roger with his back to us, working on an overhead line. He was standing on a ladder about 15 feet away, the big light bulb in a metal guard hooked on the pipe near his face. He wore blue coveralls and black rubber hip boots. I could see a denim jacket tucked across the ladder's brace. It was chilly down here, and I was glad I had my jacket on. Roger didn't turn.
"That you, Delbert?" he said over his shoulder. "That's me. I brought a friend of yours, a Miss... What is it, Kenley?"
"It's Kinsey," I corrected. Roger turned. The light glittered in his eyes and bleached all the color from his flesh.
"Well, I was expecting you," he said.
Delbert had his hands on his hips.
"You need some help with that?" "Not really. Why don't you find Paul and give him a hand?" "Will do."
Delbert started up the ladder again, leaving us alone. His head disappeared, back, hips, legs, boots. It was very quiet. Roger came down from the ladder he was on, wiping his hands on a rag, while I stood there trying to decide how to go about this. I saw him pick up the jacket and check a pocket in front.
"This is not what you think," I said.
"Listen, Lorna was getting married the weekend she was murdered. Earlier this week, a fellow picked me up in a limo with a couple of flunkies in bulging overcoats." I felt my voice trail off. He had something in his hand about the size of a walkie-talkie. Black plastic housing, a couple of buttons on the front.
"You know what this is?"
"Looks like a taser gun."
"That's right."
He pressed a button, and two tiny probes shot out on electrical wires that carried 120,000 volts. The minute the probes touched me, I was down, my whole body numb. Couldn't move, couldn't breathe. After a few seconds, my brain started to work. I knew what had happened, I just didn't know what to do about it. Of all the responses I'd imagined him making, this was not on the list. I lay on my back like a stone, trying to find a way to heave oxygen into my lungs. None of my extremities responded to cues. In the meantime, Roger patted me down, coming up with my gun, which he tucked in the pocket of his coveralls. I was making a sound, but it probably wasn't very loud. He moved to the wall and climbed the ladder. I thought he was going to leave me down there. Instead, he flipped the trap door so that it came down on the hole.
"Thought we might like a little privacy," he said as he descended.
He found a plastic bucket that had been tossed to one side. He turned it upside down and took a seat not that far from me. He leaned close. Mildly, he said,
"Fuck with me, I'll smother you with this jacket. Weak as you are, it's not going to leave any marks."
That's what he did with Lorna, I thought. He shot her with a stun gun, put a pillow across her face. Wouldn't have taken long. I felt like a baby in the early stages of development, moving my limbs randomly in an attempt to turn. Grunting, I managed to roll over on my side. I lay there breathing, looking at the wet pavement from the corner of my eye. My cheek rested on something gritty. Anthracite, sludge, small shells. I collected myself, inching my right arm up under me. I heard the trap door open, and Delbert Squalls called down,
"Roger? Yes? Guy up here to see you."
"Oh, hell," he breathed, and then to Delbert,
"Tell him I'll be right there."
I rolled an eye at him, unable to speak, and saw a grimace of impatience cross his face. He got his arms under me and hauled me into a sitting position, propping me against the wall. Like a rag doll, I sat with my legs straight out in front of me, feet tilted together, my shoulders slumped. At least I was breathing. Above me, I could hear someone walking around. I wanted to warn him. I wanted to tell him he was making a terrible mistake. While I made grunting noises, Roger was going up the ladder, his feet going tink, 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 head and shoulders disappearing. I felt tears fill my eyes. My limbs were deadened from the electrical jolt. I tried moving my arms, but the result was the same ineffectual feeling as discovering your extremities asleep. I began to flex one fist, trying to get the blood to circulate. My whole body felt oddly anesthetized. I listened, straining, but heard nothing. I struggled and finally managed to topple sideways, turning over on my hands and knees, where I remained, breathing hard, until I could gain my feet.
I don't know how long it took. All was silence above. I reached for the ladder and clung to the closest rung. After a moment, I began my ascent. By the time I climbed out, there was no sign of anyone in the corridor. I forced myself forward. I'd begun to navigate better, but my arms and legs still felt oddly disconnected. I reached his office, where I peered in the door, leaning on the frame. There was no sign of him. My gun had been placed neatly in the center of his blotter. I crossed to the desk and picked it up, tucking it into the small of my back again. I left the office, moving into the reception area. Delbert Squalls was sitting at the desk, leafing through the telephone book, probably ordering pizzas for the night crew. He looked up as I passed. I said, "Where'd Roger go?"
"Don't tell me he left you down there. Man's got no manners. You just missed him. He took off with that guy in the overcoat. Said he'd be right back. You want to leave him a note?"
"I don't think that's necessary."
"Oh, well, suit yourself."
He went back to his search.
"Good night, Delbert."
"Night.
Have a good evening," he said, reaching for the phone.
I emerged from the building into the chill night air. The wind had picked up again, and the sky, though cloudless, bore the fragrance of a distant rain heading in this direction. There was no moon, and the stars looked as though they'd been blown up against the mountains. I went down the stairs to the slot where my car was parked. I let myself into the VW and turned the key in the ignition, pulling out onto the road that led back to town. As I crossed the intersection, I thought I caught sight of a limousine slipping into the dark. Epilogue. The last chapter. Roger Bonney hasn't been seen since that night. Only a few people understand what really happened to him. I spent a long time in conversation with Lieutenant Dolan and Cheney Phillips, and for once I told the truth. Given the enormity of what I'd done, I felt I had to accept the responsibility. In the end, after much consideration, they decided no purpose would be served in pursuing the matter. They did go through the motions of a missing persons investigation, but nothing came of it, and so it rests. Now, in the dead of night, I ponder the part I played in Lorna Kepler's story, in the laying to rest of those ghosts. Homicide calls up in us the primitive desire to strike a like blow, an impulse to inflict a pain commensurate with the pain we've been dealt. For the most part, we depend upon judicial process to settle our grievances. Perhaps we've even created the clumsy strictures of the courts to keep our savageries in check. The problem is that so often the law seems pale in its remedies, leaving us restless and unfulfilled in our craving for satisfaction. And then what? As for me, the question I'm left with is simple and haunting. Having strayed into the shadows, how can I find my way back? Respectfully submitted, Kinsey Milhone. This concludes the reading of K is for Killer by Sue Grafton. This book was read by Mary Pfeiffer.